Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm looking again at an astonishingly incisive historian, David Edgerton, whose book, The Rise and Fall of the British Nation, has really done a huge amount for 20th century British historiography. It's an indispensable read if you are a student of modern Britain. And today I'm returning to looking at Margaret Thatcher. The reason why is because so much of what is said about her is mythologized, misunderstood, which is kind of easy and understandable with this divisive figure. And David Edgerton's introduction to exploring her from 1979 to 1990 is looking at the kind of the intellectual climate of Thatcherism, and that's what I want to talk about today. Not so much Margaret Thatcher as the figure. I suppose with the kind of the recent series of The Crown on Netflix, she's become a kind of a trending and zeitgeistish kind of figure, one which I think is given a kind of fairly sympathetic treatment on the programme. But understanding the kind of the philosophical context in which she existed, I think is really important. And I'm not just talking about the old chestnuts that we're going to have on this podcast before about kind of Hayek and Friedman and the kind of the intellectual godfathers, if you will, of neoliberal thought, but really the wider kind of intellectual and cultural climate of the late 1970s. So let's dive in. David Edgerton writes, "Politics changed in the 1970s. But in ways that are not well described by the concept of an end to consensus. Much more was changing than the politics between parties. Intra-party politics were especially important. For some, the main division lay between the right and the left of the Labour Party. For others, between the new right of the Conservative Party and the rest of parliamentary politics. Two key political drivers of new ideas in the 1970s, Tony Benn and Margaret Thatcher, represented positions which were critical of the positions of their own parties. For both, 1975, their 50th year, was particularly important. Tony Benn, without question the leader of the left, led an anti-EEC campaign that year, losing decisively, and as a result was demoted from the industry to the energy portfolio in the Labour government. Margaret Thatcher stood against and defeated Edward Heath as leader of the Conservative Party and took that party sharply to the right. She campaigned for a yes vote in the referendum. Now, all kind of oddly topical and prophetic. The first thing to kind of pick apart there is this idea of the end to the consensus. Now, what does that mean? Okay, so there's been a popular belief, somewhat overstated, amongst historians and political scientists, that the post-war governments from 1945 onwards, which were mainly conservative, some Labour, mainly conservative, represented a kind of a loose political consensus that had shifted towards the left, the idea that there was going to be a welfare state, nationalisation, trade unions and collective bargaining, that trade unions would have a significant role within the workings of the state. But also, there was aspects of a right consensus. The Labour Party, both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, agreed on the retention of the monarchy, wide aspects of the class system, nuclear weaponry, militarism. The point that David Edgerton makes in this book is that far from being a welfare state after 1945, Labour and Conservative governments created a warfare state. They created a state of high levels of military spending, of constant military engagement in colonial and post-colonial conflicts, of, up until the mid-1960s, national service, and of a hugely, hugely expensive commitment to the atomic bomb and later to Trident nuclear deterrent. So the idea that a consensus splintered in the 1970s is to some extent correct. Margaret Thatcher does take the Conservative Party sharply to the right. However, Edward Heath before her had been proposing some of the basic tenets of the new right thinking of the Conservative Party. His was a more managerial approach, the idea that, as with Harold Wilson, in roughly the same time period, though the two men radically dislike one another, that better scientific management of the state and of British capitalism would bring about superior results. Margaret Thatcher believed in a different approach to economic transformation, and that was the power of markets. Her full conversion to introducing British state and society to market forces, which she arguably never really fully succeeds in, happens in stages throughout her prime ministership. In 1979, there is little discussion of privatisation, of taking state utilities out of state hands and floating them on the stock market. There's not much talk of that at all. There is more a tone of kind of national revivalism, of dealing with endemic problems of law and order, the bloodshed in Northern Ireland, of putting Britain back on the map, giving Britain its national pride back and self-confidence. And that's one of the things that is highly, highly attractive. In terms of talking about the EEC referendum, after Edward Heath took Britain into the EEC, the forerunner to the EU, in 1973, there was a referendum on the subject in 1975. There was not the degree of Euroscepticism that dominates the right of British politics now, but actually Euroscepticism was more clearly articulated on the left. So the likes of Tony Benn on the left of the Labour Party believed that the EUC would be an unaccountable club of capitalists, highly exploitative, and it would be impossible to remove Britain from it, and also impossible to have accountability over who ran the EUC. The rights and wrongs of that position are kind of a subject of a different podcast, really. But the conclusive defeat, there was a referendum under the second Wilson government, or the third Wilson government, if you will, that followed Heath in 1975. And it's curious that Margaret Thatcher, who is held up by Britain's current Eurosceptics as being the kind of like the handmaiden of Brexit, was one of the ardent Remainers of the day. Later on, of course, it was Margaret Thatcher that pioneered the single market. There was a broad cross-party consensus for Remain and for Leave at the time, not that they were called those things. They were the Labour right and the Conservative right under Enoch Powell, and the Labour left had less to do with one another, but the centre ground of both parties collaborated and cooperated highly in order to win the referendum. The issues of the Conservative Party at the time were based in partly to do with a kind of Thatcher and Keith Joseph, who was her ideological mentor, in their decision, their dogged determination to stick to manifesto pledges. The manifesto pledges that Heath had set out in 1970 had been about dealing with the problems of trade union power and wage restraint. Heath had caved on almost every single promise, and Thatcher believed that it was a betrayal of the voters and a betrayal of the party for Heath to have done so, and that the purpose of a leader was to stick determinedly to what was promised. Which, you know, to her own political detriment, she did time and time again. So let us move on. Both Ben and Thatcher came into their moments of greatest power in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister, Tony Benn as leader of a Labour left, which was able to change the policies of the Labour Party very substantially. If there had ever been a post-war consensus, they would both certainly have broken it. Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister in 1979. Under her determined leadership, the trade unions were brought to heel, and the British decline her supporters claimed finally began to be reversed. Industries nationalised in the 1940s and earlier were later now privatised and liberalised. So were industries born from within the state machine. There was an economic transition from manufacturing to services, which, it was claimed, British firms did very well, creating a uniquely competitive European economy, which became a model for many. Margaret Thatcher in office for 11 consecutive years was forced out in 1990 to be replaced by John Major, who won the 1992 election, with the consequence that the Conservatives would be in power for a remarkable 8 years.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
18 years. The country was transformed economically and ideologically to a degree not seen since the 1940s. For people like Margaret Thatcher, the 1970s had been a decade of trauma. It had been a decade of relative national decline. It had been a decade of IRA violence and British violence and loyalist violence in Northern Ireland and IRA violence on the streets of London. It had been a decade where not only the perception of a decline in law and order, but the actual reality had increased. But it had also been a decade of labour disputes, of union unrest, and of inflation, ending with the winter of discontent, where strikes had paralysed the country, and with a period of the 3-day week during the dying year of the dying years of the Heath administration. So Thatcher could identify in her mind everything that had gone wrong in Great Britain. She equated it with socialism, she equated it with collectivism. She said that socialism goes ill with this country, and that a spirit of enterprise and individualism had been lost. That freeing individuals from collective bonds so that they could forge their own destinies and be responsible was how Britain would be reformed, reborn, and altered and changed. Margaret Thatcher had as much withering contempt for the gentleman aristocrats or the gentleman capitalists of the City of London and for the kind of paternalist Tories of the centre and the left of the Conservative Party, the likes of Jim Pryor and Willie Whitelaw, as she did for the trade union movement, and saw all of these as institutional barriers to the kind of radical change she believed the country needed. The idea that market forces were an expression of individual liberty, what people chose to buy and sell, what people chose to own, and that these things were stymied. This is directly from the kind of the Friedrich von Hayek playbook, just to kind of bring anyone up to speed who's not familiar with the things we've talked about Hayek on this podcast before. Hayek's most famous book, the 1945 book, The Road to Serfdom, I apologise, actually, I think that's 1947, I will check, was supposedly something that Thatcher kept in her handbag and read at Oxford University while she was studying chemistry, waving it to her cabinet saying, "This is what we believe." And it essentially said that that collectivism and the growth of the state were inherently totalitarian and they would rob individuals of their liberty. And this was the source of kind of any kind of totalitarianism, from communism to fascism. And it was only through the operation of free markets, the ability of individuals to control their wealth and their personal destiny, that would that liberty would be maintained. You could argue that initially this is a fairly legitimate political ideology. It's one perhaps with holes in it, but one that was based in a kind of a reasonable assessment of world conditions, and one which was kind of sincerely held. But it very quickly became, throughout the 1980s, a kind of a manifesto for tax dodgers, for tax loopholes and tax havens, and for the kind of the permission to downgrade any kind of collectivism from trade union membership to the NHS to communally owned council housing or state owned council housing, which obviously begins the kind of the grand unpicking and unravelling of the kind of the glues that hold societies together, thus resulting here in 2020 with in Britain and with all the countries that sort of emulated this model, with enormous and epic levels of wealth inequality. David Edgerton writes, "For both Margaret Thatcher and Tony Benn, their push for new policies was in part about recapturing a past. Margaret Thatcher's policies were in some respects about a return to the 1950s, a period she identified with." This is the happiest point of her life, growing up with her father, who was an Alderman Roberts in Grantham. This was a period of high defence spending, a clear bipartisan commitment to national nuclear weapons, to close relations with the USA, to the capitalist economy, and to limited welfare spending. All this was threatened in the 1970s by the rise of the unions and the left of the Labour Party. Thus, in 1979, the Tory manifesto did not attack the post-war consensus, but what had happened in the recent past, pointing to the fact that Labour governments had dominated by being in office for 11 out of the previous 15 years. Certainly, in some respects, the 1974 Labour programme broke with the previous one, but the really big break came after 1979. By 1983, the left had pushed the Labour Party into a position which involved withdrawal from the EEC, rejection of nuclear weapons, and elimination of US nuclear bases, and a strong dose of nationalist economic planning. By this standard, the Conservative Party certainly stood for the post-war consensus in substance, though not in style. And yet, one could also see the Labour programme of 1983 as a plea for a return to the past. Though it was never expressed in this way, Labour advocated the national protected economy with an interventionist state outside the EEC, which had been the post-war norm. In many respects, the left was looking to finally bring about the promise of those years, which they saw as unrealised because of the political power of British capitalism and the political and ideological weakness of previous Labour governments. The difficulty was that business was a business. The Conservative Party and the Labour right had long moved from this past to decisively support the EEC and to reject economic nationalism. So here we have a fascinating sort of dichotomy, a fascinating division between the forces of the economic right, the Conservative Party, British capitalism, by 1983, and the right of the Labour Party, who were not in the ascendancy at that moment. These were in quite literal sense, the neoliberals, people who believed in the economic liberalism of the 19th century, reinvented and reimagined in the 20th century. People who believed in low tariffs, in free trade areas like the EEC, later to become the EU, of course. And it was Tony Benn and the Labour left that represented a more defined version of economic nationalism. The idea that Britain did not need to be part of a multinational trading bloc, and that it did not need to surrender any kind of sovereignty to that entity. In fact, that it could actually place tariff walls around it in order to protect British industry, a lot of these ideas wildly unworkable, and create almost like a kind of an autarkic type of state, and in doing so, place the focus of economic activity on simply raising living standards for ordinary people at the expense of any gains by capital. If you were a British businessman in the 1970s, you would look at this with horror. You would think that Labour had lost its mind. You would imagine that any chances of you either selling goods abroad or using cheap labour markets in Britain or anywhere else in order to make your goods were gone, and that instead you would face now great difficulties selling abroad. Your market would be domestic, you would be selling towards to British people, and you would be selling on terms dictated probably by a Labour government and the corporatism of the trade union movement. So this is very, very unattractive to British capital. Tony Benn argued that this was ultimately the only democratic way to run an economy, because it is an economy run in the interest of the demos, of the majority of the population, and it is the way in which you prevent capital accumulating and therefore wealth, buying political power and wealth and a sort of a cabal of economic and political forces dictating the distribution of wealth in society. On the subject of the consensus, David Edgerton writes, "Perhaps the best way to think about this is to cast out any thought of a general consensus being broken, and rather to see both major parties revising their positions radically, both looking to create semi-mythical pasts and to create a new future. Furthermore, the policies of the parties interacted with each other. Tories reacted to the extension of social democracy in the 1970s, just as Labour reacted to the market liberalism of the Conservatives after 1979. In both cases, they reacted in ways which drove their positions, always different, further apart." Okay, so I think we'll return to that in the not-too-distant future. But understanding that kind of aspect of the kind of the economic, ideological underpinnings of Thatcherism and the 1980s, I believe is hugely important. So thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do pop by our Explaining History Facebook group. There's always a lively discussion going on there about something or other, and we will catch you soon. Thanks, all the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.